Well, good evening to you all. Hope we're all well. I'm just going to pray before I start. Lord, we thank you for these gifts, and Lord, we thank you that you use what you've given to us for the extension of your own kingdom. And Lord, we just pray that the words I would be saying have something of you in them, and that, Lord, they would land with our hearts, our souls, our minds. Amen. Amen. Well, a very warm welcome to you. If I've not met you before, my name is John. I, with my wife, Jo, we lead the student work here. A little whoop if you're a student. Not bad. A little private plug, if I may. Beers and Carols, Silly Beers and Carols on Tuesday. If you are a student, if you're in the first 100 students, so obviously we're probably around 100 here, we're maybe slightly under, the intention is that you would then bring someone along with you. If you are a student, if you have an NUS card, you get a free drink on the door. I know, first 100, very, very exciting. So just come prepared for that. Anyway, I work as part of the team here doing the student stuff with Jo. I'm also studying myself. I'm also known as Fresher John. I'm in my first year of studying as well, so you can adopt that if you so wish to. Just to give you a little bit of context, the four weeks we've had until now, we've been exploring what a life of discipleship looks like here in the city as a group of people, as a body trying to live life well in the city, what it looks like to become more and more like Jesus, to essentially be an apprentice of him and do the things he did. So if you are new or visiting, or if you just missed any of them, go back and listen to them. They are critical. They're very, very exciting. I feel like they're going to be such a foundation for the next months, years of us as a church. So do go back to that. And next week, obviously, the festivities of Christmas kick in. And we're all very excited about that. Some Christmas jumpers already on the front row. It's very exciting to see. But this week, it means we're in a slightly odd one. We're going to change the pace slightly. It doesn't have a lot to do with Christmas. It doesn't have a huge amount to do with discipleship. It's going to sit in between. But essentially, I'm going to be talking about a story. A story that's... Wow, the lights have come on in the Christmas jumper. That is unbelievably distracting. But great. So good. So good. I'm just going to focus on this side of the room. I'm going to be talking about a story that we see in the Old Testament. It is a short story, a concise story, a fast-paced one, an exciting one. It's one of love, of drama, of betrayal. It gets racy at times. It's got cliffhangers. And ultimately, it's a story of God's grace and God yearning after his people. So we are going to be looking at the story of Esther. So some of us will know this story well. Some of us will know it from a kind of Sunday school life. It might have been years since you've opened Esther. We're going to try and run through it pretty quickly so that we're all on the same page, and then we're going to try and draw out what can we get from it. It's a story where God appears to be almost completely absent, and yet it's a story where we can learn so much about God, his nature, what he wants to do with his people. So we are going to go through that very quickly. If you have a Bible in front of you, grab it. Go to Esther. It's about a third of the way through. If you don't have a Bible, we say this regularly, please, please take this away with you. Like, this is a gift from us to you. We really think this will be life-giving. So do take it away. Write your name in it. It's a gift from us to you. Otherwise, go to Esther. It's about a third of the way through. Just to give you some context, the Jewish people at this point, so the chosen people of God, are in absolute danger. They are a religious minority in this empire of Persia. The Persians were the most powerful and prolific empire at the time. They had everything in their own sight. Their spiritual and moral values were completely at odds with the Jewish people. The Jewish people had no king, they had no army, they had no land, they were unbelievably vulnerable. And we're going to be following four characters in particular. I'm going to introduce you to them now. Esther is our first one, the most obvious one perhaps. She's our heroine, our protagonist in many ways. The crown gives it away slightly, a little bit of a spoiler alert there, sorry. She does become a queen later on. We're going to see how that works. Her cousin, her older cousin, is Mordecai, a wise man. Top half of the screen means these guys are good, just to give you a little spoiler there as well. The kind of big, fluffy beard, the Father Christmas look. He's a good man. He's a man of wisdom. He's a man of God. We're going to be following him as well. Now into the bottom half, the baddies. We've got the kind of Aladdin Jafar beard going on here. Haman is our true baddie. He's the worst one of the four. We're going to have boos and hisses going through today. Please don't. Actually, it'll make it a lot longer. And he is the second in command to King Xerxes. And King Xerxes is the emperor of Persia. He is the man, the most powerful man in the world at this time. And we're going to be starting off with him. So I'm going to be following through kind of five scenes, if you will, of Esther. I'm not going to go through it chapter by chapter. Just flick it in front of you. If you've got it, you'll kind of pick up where I'm going with it. And we're going to start with King Xerxes. So King Xerxes is having a banquet. Scene one, we're in a banquet. Immediately from verse one, we start with a party. King Xerxes has got all the leaders of the land, all the nobles, all the oligarchs, all of the kind of famous, wealthy people. And he's got them all in front of him, and he's got a six-month banquet, a six-month party, where he's going to show every single one of them all of his wealth, all of the things that he owns, completely showing off, a completely proud man. And we follow the story where he is showing all of these things through, and it's about 7 days into this banquet, into this party, when we see this happen. It says, on the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him to bring him Queen Vashti. Queen Vashti was his wife at the time, not one of our key characters, but a secondary role, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. So immediately we see a proud man, a powerful man, completely dishonored, completely dethroned almost in his arrogance. She does something unbelievably bold, something unbelievably antisocial for the time, going against all of the cultural and social norms. And as a man of complete pride and of complete fear of uprising across this empire, does three things. The first thing he does is the most obvious. He gets rid of Vashti. We don't hear about her ever again in this story. We don't know what happened to her. We don't know where she went. We don't know for her standing up for what she believed in, for standing up against the things that were wrong. We don't know what happened to her. The second thing he did was, fear of there being uprising across all the wives of the empire, he says that all women will respect their husbands, which is a bold statement. And thirdly, he starts a search for a new queen. That leads us on to chapter number two. So we kind of have this moment where he wants to exert his authority again. He wants to show again that he's powerful, that he has control over what's going on. So he searches for a new queen to be in the place of Vashti. And we've kind of got like a Persia's Got Talent moment here. So every single province sends forward their best possible person, their kind of best proposal for who this queen could be. Who comes to the king, and they have this moment with him. It's kind of a little bit like the Hunger Games, where they have a minute to demonstrate why they're so good. They have a minute to demonstrate what their talents are, what they can offer, what they can bring, and so that they might be the best in the kingdom. They might be the queen. And I don't know about you. I don't know how many of you hopefully will have gone on dates before. Date night for us in the Carter household is a Monday night. And preparation for me looks something like this. I'm normally at college on a Monday. I normally come back. I probably will do a little kind of squirt of Boss Hugo Boss just to freshen up a little bit, get ready for the evening. Joe's probably a little bit longer, not too much longer. We'll probably get the 2-for-1 voucher for the cinema. Monday nights are a pretty good one for that. Probably Pizza Express. Monday nights, top tip, are a great night for date night. You do get a lot of 2-for-1s during the midweek time of the week. That has nothing like what Esther has to deal with. She has to spend 12 months preparing for this one moment of greatness. All of these women, there's probably about 1,000 of them in all, spent 12 months preparing themselves for this one moment with the king. What pressure. What unbelievable pressure to put on these young women. 6 months of oil and myrrh, 6 months of perfumes and cosmetics. And we read, it says in the text, that she won favor and approval from everyone that she met, including the king. So astonishingly, this woman who's total outcast, she's a Jew herself, she's part of this people who've been completely vulnerable and kind of let out from they have no security, suddenly becomes this queen of this incredible empire called Persia. Unbelievable moment. Not only that, she becomes the undercover Jew. So she's so fearful, obviously, because of being this kind of vulnerable nation of the Jewish people, that actually she doesn't even reveal herself to be a Jew. An unbelievable moment. This vulnerable people becomes suddenly the queen of Persia. So we move on to scene number three. Whilst all of that's going on with Esther, we see Mordecai, her cousin, top right. Just to remind you, he's a good one. He's got a beard. He's got wisdom and stature. He spends a lot of time looking after Esther. So he spends a lot of time in the environment of the king's palace. And as he's doing so, he just sits out there. He's listening to conversations that are going on. And one of the conversations he hears is from two officials, two attendants of the king, who want to plot to kill the king. And he's trying to figure out, what do I do with this? I mean, he's not actually a great guy, King Xerxes. Interesting, could leverage a little bit of kind of influence here. So he goes to Esther. He kind of peers through the fence. Probably not exactly what he does, but he peers through the fence and says, Esther, you're not going to believe what's going on here. I think you should tell him. Maybe that will give you some influence. So they essentially have this trail where the king finds out that these guys are trying to kill him. And Esther gives all of the glory, all of the recognition of that to Mordecai. That's very important, and we're going to come to that later, but we'll come to it in a minute. And those two officials eventually get impaled on poles. There's a lot of impaling on poles. I'm just going to throw that out there in Esther. Almost every death is an impaling on poles. If that's what you're into, go and check it out in Esther. So, scene number four. This is the key one. This is the reversal. I've called it reversal. I'll explain why in a minute. Everyone, this is where we're introduced to Haman, by the way. Everyone who walks into the king's presence has to kneel or bow to Haman. So he is given this kind of order from the king that everyone must do this. And Mordecai refuses to kneel. He's the only one who doesn't do it. He's completely dishonoring him again. Completely dishonoring what this empire are trying to do. And Haman is absolutely furious. He wants to kill Mordecai. Not only does he want to kill Mordecai, he wants to kill everything that Mordecai represents, the whole nation and people that Mordecai is representing, which is the Jewish people. And we see this moment, it says in chapter 3, it says, if it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. This is Haman saying to the king, I want to kill all these guys. You don't know why I want to do it. I'm not going to give you a reason why I want to do it. Not only would I want to do it, I'm going to pay. I'm going to self-fund this whole execution. And the king says, yeah, that's fine. You can do whatever you want. Do you know what? Keep the money. I'll pay for it. And what he doesn't know is that that's the very nation that his wife is part of. It's the very people group that his wife belongs to. So Mordecai and Esther are trying to figure out what to do in this moment. Do they confront the king? Do they go to him and say, no, 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 you need to stop doing this. I'm going to reveal who I am. That's punishable by death. She can't do that. She's too vulnerable to even do that. It's completely illegal for her to do so. But perhaps it's her time. Maybe this is her time to stand up, to play the role she's supposed to do. And there's an amazing verse that where Mordecai is saying to Esther in chapter 4, he says, who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. In other words, maybe this is the very thing that you've been born to do. Maybe this is the moment that you were born for. And this is often like what people turn to in Esther. And they say, wow, what a brave woman. She turned her whole life upside down. She was so brave, and she was so brave. It's one of so many moments in this whole book where we see God moving, where we see his authority and his sovereignty. So Esther does confront the king. She invites him and Haman to a banquet. She's going to kind of explain this whole story. It's the pinnacle. It's the climax of the whole book. What's she going to do? Is she going to stand up and be counted? Is she going to do the right thing, or is she going to bail? The next 24 hours are absolutely key. So that same day, Haman and his arrogance, he wants to kill Mordecai. Remember, he builds a 75-foot pole. So we've got the poles that impale people. He's going to go for an even bigger one than there's ever been before. So 75-foot pole that he's going to impale Mordecai on and show the whole nation what's going to happen to them. He's trying to make a mockery of this man, of his people. And that same night, the king tries to go to sleep, King Xerxes, and can't do it. So he can't, he just, for some reason, it's the one night, we don't know if it was a problem he had, but he has insomnia. And the arrogance that he has, and the utter self-centeredness of a man that he is, and the pride he has, the way that he gets to sleep is he comes and gets an attendant to come in and read the books, which are the reports of like his kingdom and what he's done, what his reign has looked like. So he's reading through everything that he's done as a king, everything that's happened to him. And one of the things that comes up is the incredible act of Mordecai who was dobbing in those two officials who were going to go and kill Xerxes. So for the first time, Xerxes is reminded of what this guy has done. Out of nowhere, complete coincidence. So he hears about this. He says, what did we do to honor him? We must do something. I remember I was going to like buy him a gift, take him out for dinner, something like that. And the attendant says, no, we didn't do anything. I'm really sorry, we actually haven't honored him yet. And he goes, fascinating. So he gets, that's a student gag. I say fascinating a lot. So he gets Haman in the morning, comes to his bed, and he says, Haman, can you give me some advice? There's someone I really want to honor. What do you think I should do to honor him? So Haman, thinking it's all about him, thinking this is my time, this is the moment I've been waiting for my whole life. The king is going to honor me, he's going to love me. Oh, I need affection. He says, right, there's a few things you're going to do. One, why don't you put on your cloak, the king's cloak, the emperor's cloak, onto him, a kind of sign of like giving him authority, sharing in the authority of the king. Why don't you parade him around the city? You know, just give him all these gifts, all these lavish wonders that you want to do. And he says, yeah, great, I'm going to do that. Haman, little does he know that it's nothing to do about him. It's about the man that he later that day was going to try and kill. So the king orders Haman to do all those wonderful things for Mordecai. Mordecai gets completely honored. Haman knows this is the beginning of the end. Imagine that moment, like you think everything's going well. He didn't even have to pay for this execution. And suddenly it's all turned on its head overnight, literally overnight. So this is the dramatic twist of the story. And Haman is killed on the very thing that he built to kill Mordecai. There's an amazing verse where one of the attendants, it's like he just nudges the king who's really angry and just says, there is a thing there that you could kill Haman on if you wanted to. And it's just this moment where the whole story turns on its head. Haman has built the very thing that actually kills him, that he was trying to kill goodness and stamp down on it. And our final scene is the triumph. We see that this story concludes with Esther successfully pleading for the kingdom of the Jewish people, for them not to be killed. It concludes with this in chapter 8. It says, for the Jews, it was a time of happiness and joy, gladness and honor in every province and in every city to which the edict of the king came. There was joy and gladness among the Jews, with feasting and celebrating, and many people of other nationalities became Jews because fear of the Jews had seized them, which is a whole other talk in itself and actually really fascinating. But we just see this utter moment of jubilation. They've done it. They've won. And Haman, our baddie, he's left for dead. So bottom left, he's gone. He's out of the picture. He gets killed. King Xerxes, he lives a few more years. He eventually gets assassinated from a group of his closest advisors. One of them was called Megabus. It's a genuine thing. Megabus was actually the name of one of his advisors. Esther, top left, our queen, she marks what happens by starting a festival for the Jews called Purim. They still celebrate that today, and it's a moment they look back and say, look at what God did, look at his faithfulness, look at the story that he's ushered us into. And Mordecai, one of our heroes, again, he is honored. His parting words of the book in Esther are this. It says, Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. An extraordinary story of good beating evil, but like over time, in incremental things, the coincidences that happen, it always wins, it always wins, it always wins, but always at the last minute. That's what we see in Esther. So it's an extraordinary story, and I'm sorry that we've zoomed through it so fast. If you do get like 20 minutes this week, I encourage you to read it. It's actually really, really gripping. It's really exciting stuff. And there's so much stuff to go through or to that you could pull out from this. And I realized pretty quickly after choosing to look at Esther why no one does one single talk on Esther, because there's so much that you could put into a talk, and you can't ever do it justice. So do go and read it. It's extraordinary stuff. But I want to just pull out one kind of theme from it. And we're going to ask two questions. We're going to ask these two things. Where is God? Where is God in this book, in this story, in the person of Esther, in her character, in the characters of the other people around her? And what is he doing? What's God actually doing? Is he doing anything? Is God even there? And I want to suggest there's two exciting things here. One is, this is so important to ask those questions if you're reading any scripture, ever. Like, where is God in this story? Where is God in the scripture? What is he doing? But more than that, in our day to day, I'm trying to get into a rhythm of this. Start my day by saying, Lord, where are you? Where are you in my day? What are you doing? Because I just feel convicted that if we're asking those questions of our day to day, we just can't go wrong. It focuses us on him. It focuses us on his story. We're being ushered into what he's doing, not inviting him simply into what we're doing. Where is he? What is he doing? And how do we get involved? So we're going to ask those two questions very briefly. On the surface, he's not there at all. He's totally absent. It's the one book of the Bible where God is not mentioned. God isn't even hinted at. There's no reference of him. There's no reference of prayers, of any spiritual acts of any kind. So in some ways, God is completely absent. And yet in many other ways, God's silence here is absolutely not his absence. We see God's fingerprints, his marks all over this story, all over what's going on in these characters. I live about 10-minute walk up the road, and I don't know if anyone else is local, but when I'm driving around up Holloway Road, which has been doing a load of roadworks for the last 6 months or so, there's always a disappointing moment. It's awful to drive there anyway at the best of times because it takes ages. But what happens is whilst you're queuing for the hour to get to the roadworks, you see the roadworks sign. When you're driving past, there's no one working. Like, you literally look and nothing's going on there. This happens on motorways all the time. You spend ages queuing for something, and then you drive past expecting to see like a big hole in the ground. Actually, it's like half the road's been cordoned off, but nothing's happening. And you're a bit like, what's actually going on? And I feel like that's sometimes our view of God. Is like, we see the roadwork signs, we hear constantly that God's doing something, and yet we don't actually see him doing it. Someone helpfully doctored one of these signs. I think that sometimes our view is like, constantly we come to roadworks and there's just someone sitting there having a tea. That's disrespectful to people who work in that field. You do a very good job. And it always gets done on time and on budget. And we're very grateful. But we get this same sense in Esther. Is like, there's no mention of God. There's no reference of him. In fact, many times it avoids mentioning God. There are a few times where it could so easily fall into that. Mordecai's walking around with sackcloth and ashes. That's like indicative of what the Jewish people would do if they're fasting and praying for something to happen. And yet they don't even mention that. And there's loads of interesting reasons why that might be. But ultimately, we see that although he's not mentioned, we can see him being his fingers all over this story. We're wrapped up in the narrative of God in the story of Esther. In Genesis 12, just to flick back right to the beginning of the Bible, God makes a promise to Abraham. He says this, he says, I'll make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I'll make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And the point here is he's calling out his chosen people, his nation, his people, the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, and he's saying, I'm going to use you to reach the many. I'm going to use you to reach everyone else, and I'm going to do a covenant which means that I'm never going to break that promise. Nothing will stop that. And we see it in Esther. This is the fulfillment of some of that stuff. Time and time again in the Old Testament, they come so close to messing up. They come so close to it all going wrong. And yet God is remarkably faithful. In this story of Esther, the Jewish people are on the brink of disaster. They are literally overnight away from being completely wiped out. Like, it's so interesting to read Esther and think it's a really fun story about these characters who are doing extraordinary things. And we forget this is a real people in real time, God's chosen people who are about to get wiped out. Everyone who lived next to someone who was Jewish was given an order. It literally got sent out from the king that said, if you, on a certain day, it was in like the 13th month of the year, which obviously doesn't ring true for us now, on the 13th month of the year, that you can kill the people in that house and you can take their wealth. An incentive to kill them was to take their stuff. So they were literally overnight, the one night which King Xerxes couldn't get to sleep, they were that close to being completely wiped out. The covenant of God being broken, the unbreakable covenant. So we see that whilst being on the brink of disaster, God time and time again is faithful. God time and time again comes through for his people. When we scratch even further beneath the surface of this book, we see that the whole narrative and the way that God works is revealed. Like, we see it obviously in the people of Israel and the Jewish people and what this promise is to them in Genesis. But we also see signs of the cross. We see kind of echoes and hints at it. Like, the very thing that Haman built to destroy goodness and destroy all that was good and all that was promised of the Jewish people was the very thing that killed him. If that's not an articulation of what the cross is doing, where us and mankind trying to build the very thing to kill God, and God using that on its head to kill evil, I don't know what is a better articulation of what's going on in the cross. So we see that God is at work, where we don't see his name, we see his fingerprints all over this, doing the very things he promises, despite appearances. But not only where is God and we see him in it, but what is he actually doing? How is he doing these things? And in the stories of the Old Testament, if you look before this and after this, there are unbelievable moments of spectacular action. Like Pete was saying at the beginning about parting the sea, and that could mean that the impossible could be made possible. And all of that's true, and we see extraordinary moments, pillars of fire. We see plagues that wipe out enemies, but we also see the utterly ordinary. God using the everyday people, God changing the everyday through the everyday people and through the everyday characters. And what I love about Esther, it's one of the most realistic and encouraging stories that we could see in the Bible, because it's utterly normal. It's utterly natural. It's actually utterly relatable for us today. Every single one of the things that happens there is a coincidence. We see a drunken and boastful king who banishes his wife, his queen. That kickstarts a whole process of a new queen being chosen, which would free the Jewish people and actually give them an elevated respect and elevated authority. We see a beauty pageant which just unbelievably gets this one girl, this one Jewish girl, wins this whole contest. An overheard plot from Mordecai to kill a king, and a timely night of insomnia. I remember my dad, when he tried to explain what was going on in the Christmas story when you were a kid and like your parents are trying to explain what's going on. One of the characters he always focused a lot on was Joseph. And it's not a character that we focus a lot of time on. And in these few weeks, we'll probably kind of read him in the carol service readings, and we'll just kind of float over him because we're focused on Jesus, and rightly so. But there's just a few amazing moments with him. In the beginning of Matthew, the first two chapters is where we really see him take center stage, Joseph. And he has three moments where he makes an active decision to do something very, very small, which changes the course of history. The first moment he wants to, it says in Matthew that he's going to divorce Mary quietly because he doesn't want to disrespect her, but he also realizes that she's pregnant, and he's very, very confused, and he thinks that she's probably done something strange, but he doesn't want to disown her and kind of completely dishonor her, so he'll just say, I'm going to do this quietly. And he gets prompted by the Lord through an angel, no, that's not the right thing to do. And he acts on that and he makes a decision, okay, I'm going to stand by her. So he becomes the father of the Son of God. And similarly, Herod goes and sends out some people to try and kill all of the babies. And he's also prompted again from the angel to go and leave and go to Egypt. And he does that very thing. He just takes a very small decision. Okay, this is the right thing to do. And he moves. And then back again, he does it. He goes back to Nazareth. All these things are so small. They're such tiny decisions. They're prompted by God, sure, but they are such small decisions, such everyday decisions, where to go, where to be, when to move, all of that kind of thing. And they've completely transformed the course of history, completely transformed them. My dad always used to say that it's Joseph doing the next right thing, just the very next step. All he had to do was do that next right thing, and that would change the whole story. And it's the same here. When we zoom in on a few moments, we see that characters are just doing the next right thing. So we're just going to zoom in on three of them very, very quickly. So Queen Vashti, early on, we read this. It says, on the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits on wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs to serve him, to bring Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. And when we read it before, and it's kind of interesting and exciting, and then that means this new queen's going to come, and we just forget about Vashti. When we read it again and we realize, what's going on? Like, why is she doing that? That's crazy. Like, she would have known that she was in such risk. There was such personal risk for her, social risk, like it was against all the social and cultural norms, physical risk. One of the reasons we probably don't know anything about her is because probably something not very nice happened to her as a result of this.
And yet she wanted to stand up and say, no, this isn't all that I'm about. I'm not all just about parading my beauty for all these men and then just leaving again. She took a really small but unbelievably courageous decision to do that. Not particularly driven by faith, not one moving towards God. And yet that one very ordinary decision allowed a whole string of events to happen after it. Secondly, we see something similar with Mordecai. It says that all the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him, he was enraged. Like, Haman is the personification of pride. He is the personification of self-interest. And time and again, we see Haman's need for affection, his need to know that he's loved and adored. And Mordecai says, no, I'm not going to bow down to that. Literally or metaphorically, I'm not going to allow this man to feel all these things that aren't right. He does it at unbelievable cost. Again, in some ways, this is a monumental failure. Like, the whole Jewish people are now under threat because of one action that he's done. But he knows, principally, this isn't right to do. And actually what it does is unlock the faithfulness of God to be seen by all. So instead of the Jewish people not just being in danger in this moment and living life on, what God actually uses it for is to be able to see the extraordinary works of what he's doing with these people, to be a mark of his faithfulness. And finally, we see it in Esther. It says, then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days or a night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Again, like, we read this stuff. What an unbelievable, brave thing to say. If I perish, I perish. Remarkable. Such courageousness, such honor, and such kind of faith for what God will do. Such risk, again, social risk, the physical risk to herself and all of the Jewish people because of doing this. All of these moments that we see are catalysts. They like start the Lord being able to do the very thing that he's wanting to do. The turning points that allow God to move. And you and I are drawn into a story where we're able to be part of that. We're able to do the day-to-day decisions. Like, we sometimes will ask the first two questions and we'll say, where is God and what is he doing? But I feel like there's an invitation off the back of that, which is then to therefore do the next right thing. Like, we sometimes will buy into an unbelievably big vision of wanting to change absolutely everything, which is the right thing to do. But we sometimes think that we're so central in doing that. Like, God is going to elevate me to a ridiculously influential position, and it's only at that point that I'm going to be able to change King's Cross, I'm going to be able to change London, I'm going to be able to change this nation. It's in the everyday. It's in the coffee station conversation. It's in the housemate conversation at 3 a.m. It's in the conversation with the Deliveroo guy. It's all of those tiny moments of listening to God and saying, God, what are you doing? Where are you and what are you doing? Let me do the next right thing. When we, Joe and I moved from Nottingham about 5 years ago, so we've been here for about 5 years. And when we did that, our life up there was like, we loved it. Like, we were part of an amazing church. Joe had a job. I had a job. It was a crazy job. I didn't really have to do very much and got paid quite well. It was a bit weird, actually. Probably shouldn't have been doing it. But when we were there, we felt this prompting to come down to London, and we didn't know really why. Like, I had a job, which was fine. Joe didn't have a job, and none of it really made sense. We didn't actually love the idea of London. We've never been those people. And yet we came down, we put some money on a flat. We didn't have the money to do it. We didn't have the jobs to support the rent and all of that kind of thing. And all of them felt like nuts decisions. We're like, God, where are you? Like, we feel like you're saying something, but we also don't know where you are at all. And yet it felt like him just saying, just the next right thing, put these dominoes in a row, and that's when I act. That's when we see him doing the most thing, acting most powerfully. It felt like when you guys were being interviewed about Soul Action, there was just that amazing line in the video. It said, one school, one class, one people at a time. Like, it's very easy to buy into an unbelievably big vision and not figure out what it actually looks like to get there. It looks like one school, one class, one people at a time. It's the small decisions, it's the small moves of faithfulness. And there was a story, and I'll land with this, there's a story of Nelson Mandela, actually. He was in prison in Robben Island, just off the coast of Cape Town, for about 18 years of the 27 years that he was in prison overall. And whilst he was there, he had a prison guard who was regularly with him, and they had an interesting relationship. But there was a moment years after he'd been in prison. So he'd obviously been let out and was pivotal in seeing the end of apartheid. And there was a press conference, and it was about reconciliation. And there was a moment in it where someone afterwards said, and standing behind Nelson Mandela was this prison guard. And he said, someone had a conversation with him afterwards and said, "How can you forgive this man? How can he stand on the same stage as you? How can you let that happen? I don't understand. What faith and what forgiveness can you just muster up in that moment?" And the thing he said was, that was just a small step in a much greater number of steps. So every single day that he was in prison, every single day that he saw him, he decided to forgive him. Every day, step by step. And he said today was just another step on that process. And there's loads you could explore about forgiveness. There's loads you could explore about the power of forgiveness and what's in that. But the point here is it was just another step. It's the everyday decisions, it's the next right thing that we choose to do that matters. And I really feel that challenge and that call over our lives, that what is the next right thing for you to be doing? Like, ask the questions, God, where are you? And what are you doing? For sure, ask those questions. Start with those questions. Bury yourself and root yourself in those questions. But ask the Lord, "Lord, what are you asking me to do as the next right thing?" Just the next small step, the next small thing that takes us further and further into the purposes of God.